Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, what is going on with EB5?
Hi, Mark. Yes, there's lots and lots going on with EB5. And to help me go through and sift out all of this, I have brought in today with me Rebecca.
Hi, Mark.
Hey,
good to
Rebecca.
Be on here again.
All right. So, Mark, where do we start? There's so many things to discuss. But I thought, as everybody's asking us and everybody's talking about legislation, perhaps we should start with legislation. I'm only going to hint on legislation today because for our viewers and listeners, we have some exciting podcast coming, which is going to explain a lot more and to talk more in detail about the legislation. But we can say that although we don't have any definitive news, there's plenty of rumblings.
So, Mona, I think the biggest question everyone has, as we've been going through this for 2 years, is anything for sure going to happen in September?
You mean, are we going to have another extension? Yes, we can see all the signs and all the signals are there that there is going to be a deal, that there will be something happening in September. So I would say these few months are the hard cutoff date for all of our listeners. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned. Stay tuned to the podcast. Stay tuned to our blog. And we will keep you updated on that.
One of our other concerns that we have is that our clients are constantly bickering about the processing delays.
Bickering is not the word. They are literally ready to go and stampede USCIS. It's
understandably upset, right?
Yeah. No, it's horrible mm-hmm. right now. We just don't know what to tell our clients because the processing delays are just getting out of hand, and it's just nothing like we've ever seen before. And it's not, I would say, one specific area or mm-hmm. one project. It seems to be across the board.
Yeah, and even for approved projects or even standalone projects or direct projects, we're seeing it all across. All cases have been having significant delays.
And the interesting thing was that even last October that a representative from USCIS specifically stated that approved projects were going to get deference, people with approved exemplars were going to get deference, and we're not seeing it right now. It's just delay after delay. So, you know, as our clients are so upset, as other people are upset, we thought we would address it for a little while on today's podcast.
Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to clients?
Well, for us as a law firm, we're constantly in contact with USCIS. I want to say almost every day we're putting in service requests. We're emailing the IPO, which is the Immigrant Program Office. So that we kind of get a little bit more feedback with that as it's a direct link to them. But to be honest,
it's still frustrating.
Yeah,
it's still frustrating. Yes. They have a date whereby they are supposedly looking at projects from that date, but it doesn't make sense because we had approvals from certain projects, for example, after that date. And so I don't know if they're going backwards or if the date is just for referral for new projects. You know, it's so unsure. But there is a call with USCIS scheduled this week, Mark, and I know this is going to be brought up. So we will keep everybody abreast of what's happening.
Simona, since our clients are having all these issues, and you know, we get a lot of questions about, can I really expedite my case? Is that possible?
Well, yes and no. There is a process to expedite cases, which we're going to just talk about, but it's not for every kind of case. There are only certain cases with certain criteria which are allowed. The criteria are pretty specific. And if your case does not fall under one of these criteria, then you are not going to get your case expedited. And before you even file the case, you have to file a petition to expedite your case. So you're filing two petitions. You're filing an expedite petition, and then attached to that is your actual petition.
So what are those criteria, Mona?
As I say, they're very specific. And they refer to things like severe financial loss to a company or individual. One of the popular ones is an extreme emergent situation or a humanitarian situation. I think we have used that one the most. You can also be a non-for-profit and you can request an expedite of your case because of your non-for-profit status. And then you can also request an expedite if you have something to do with the Department of Defense or it's a national interest situation. And the other two criteria are USCIS error and a compelling interest from USCIS.
Compelling is the key word. So these criterias, you know, just maybe a small financial loss or just minor implications are not going to help your case. They have to be compelling reasons. And as Mona says, we have had successful applications where we've had expedited cases approved. Some of them were unfortunately medical situations where we've had, you know,
people on cancer
exactly.
issues or other
major issues. One of the other ones too, that is the USCIS error. And we've had successful applications with that because, of course, no one's perfect and neither is USCIS. So we've had some successful applications there as well.
But for that one, you really have to show that it was USCIS mm-hmm. error, not that you think it's a USCIS error, because that's only going to hold up the whole procedure.
Mm-hmm. So Mona, we went through our expedite. Now, my case does not fall under expedite. Is there anything else I can do?
Well, there is another option. If you do not fall under the categories to expedite, you can always go through our buddy, the Ombudsman.
And what is the Ombudsman?
All right. Well, the Office of Citizenship and Immigration Services Ombudsman, that's his whole title. That was established back in 2002 under the Bush administration, actually. But the Ombudsman is supposed to assist individuals and employers in resolving case problems with USCIS. And the Ombudsman is completely independent from USCIS, so they are able to review USCIS policies and procedures, and they can recommend changes to mitigate, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so it's very important to know that they are impartial. But the major problem is, Mona, are they an appellate body?
No, that's what you have to understand. It's not an appeal, and they cannot question USCIS decisions that were made in accordance with applicable laws and procedures. Mm-hmm. So again, you have to be very careful when you're going towards the Ombudsman. And additionally, the Ombudsman doesn't have the authority to command USCIS to open a case. For example, if you go to federal court and you manage to get a writ commanding USCIS, the USCIS have no choice but to comply. An Ombudsman really can only make a request.
Well, mm-hmm. Mona, can you give us like an example scenario that would be ideal for an Ombudsman and what perhaps a likely outcome could be from that?
Well, yes. For example, we had one case which there was a clear USCIS error, and we filed an expedite, and the expedite was actually denied. And it was like, why? It falls under the expedite error. So that's when, unfortunately, we had to go through the Ombudsman. Another time that we went through the Ombudsman was, and Rebecca, you remember the second?
yes. What we had used the Ombudsman for is when the processing times, when they are delaying cases and it's outside of the processing times. But you have to realize the Ombudsman is the very last resort. So you have to do everything first. You have to call them. There's a 1-800 number that you call. You have to put in a service request. You have to email if you don't get anything through the service request. You can schedule an InfoPass appointment. So there's several options before you actually can use the Ombudsman.
Oh, and also don't forget, with EB-5, there's a little difference between EB-5 and other immigration changes when it comes to age out children. Because for children, normally your case has to be approved before the child reaches 21 for a child not to age out. But that's not the case with EB-5. For EB-5, the case has to be filed prior to the child turning 21. Now, if there is a USCIS error or there's a delay or there is a lost file, and believe you me, this happens all the time. These are classic cases where we've used the Ombudsman.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
We just so covered a little bit about processing delays and how they're dragging on. So I can see why they would have that policy.
Right, mm-hmm. right. But there is one disadvantage. It takes 3 months usually mm-hmm. to get going on an Ombudsman case. It's not like you would write to them and they get going next week or tomorrow.
Yeah, so they're not expedite either. So if it's what it is you wait, if your case has been, like for instance, with the case processing delays, if it's 60 days outside of the processing time, then you can go ahead and contact the ombudsman. They take about, you know, they try to take 30 days to respond to you. But usually we see 60 to 90 days where they come
back. Right. And the good thing is that we get reports from the ombudsman. Mm-hmm. And the latest report was just released actually this month.
Yeah, which was very, very interesting. So the reports are very helpful in showing that one of the major issues that we saw and we've heard USCIS talk about a lot is that they have unfulfilled positions. So right now, the IPO, the Immigrant Investor Program Office that we discussed before, have 90 unfulfilled positions.
That's a lot. It's
a lot.
So if one person can handle maybe, what, 3 cases a week? So 3 multiplied by 90, no wonder they've got such delays.
Yeah, exactly. So they can
207.
Yeah. So they can speed up the processing times. Hopefully they can get those positions filled soon. Some of the others is that they give a lot of stats. So with the petitions, there's tons of petitions still pending with USCIS.
I think you gave a figure. How many petitions are actually pending right now with USCIS?
58,000 petitions are pending right now.
Wow.
And waiting, and that's
wow.
just pending. Those that are waiting for an immigrant visa, there's 30,000.
It's got to have something to do with these consistent, continual deadlines, Rebecca, don't you agree?
Oh, yes. Everyone here is September 30th. And so September 1st, everyone's rushing to get their applications in.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sounds awful. With 58,000 petitions and each petition taking time to review mm-hmm. and adjudicate. Yeah, there is going to be a delay.
Yeah. And then, you know, these numbers are far in excess of the amount of visas that are issued or available. So.
And how many petitioners are currently waiting for an immigrant visa issuance?
Yeah, that's 30,000.
30,000.
Yeah. So we have a total of 88,000 plus investors having approved or pending I-526 petitions. And there's just not enough visas for mainland China. That's an issue.
That there's some bad news for mainland China there also, because according to the current ombudsman report, the queue for dependents from China at the end of the form 526 adjudication is almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So we're hoping that something happens before then.
So hopefully we don't run into a situation where children or accompanying children that have been grandfathered in don't come in and reach the age of, well, Social Security, right?
Yeah. No, it's not good for the EB-5 business, because anybody who is filing from mainland China now, first of all, there is this slowdown from mainland China because of the time delay. But anybody who's filing really has to think 3 times as to the age of the child. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues, as well as the fact that your money is tied up for so long
mm-hmm.
if you file with EB-5, if you're from mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, this has happened before, right? Well, I think before retrogression, but they had long processing delays and increasing processing delays. Every month they would get 2 months behind. So they hired a lot more adjudicators to help with that workload in hopes that it would decrease the processing times down. But even that, it took 6 months or a year or so, because the new people came in and, you know, Parkinson's law of management, like, well, there's new people here. There's this workload. Let me dive in deeper to each case. And it still took a while before them to really catch up. Is that true?
Yes. But one thing that they are doing is that they're choosing projects and they're trying to bundle together. So if, for example, you have 30 cases filed on one particular project, if you file them more or less at the same time, or they will adjudicate all of those 30 together once they've reached that project. That's what we were told. So hopefully, but we have actually seen evidence of that. Mm-hmm. So when we start getting approvals in for a project, we tend to get a flow from that same project.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, luckily things aren't changing like a new policy manual, right? Oh, wait, I'm wrong.
Well, I think they should stop writing on policy and get on with adjudicating, because I feel like all of this policy writing is taking valuable resources away from USCIS.
Exactly.
And you know my feelings about some of the new changes or some of the new recommendations.
I'm going to get to that in a bit. Yeah, but let's talk a little bit about this new policy manual.
Well, basically, the new policy manual has been out for some time, but these are just changes that they keep on bringing And there was a new policy manual change, which came out on when? June 14th.
There were some good stuff in it, wasn't there, Mona?
Well, yes. There was a couple of good points. Actually, one thing which has confused people for a long time is your period of sustainment. What that means mm-hmm. is how long your money has to stay inside a project. And they actually did define that in the new policy manual. They defined it as being the period of conditional residence, which will begin from the date you get your conditional residence card until exactly the 2-year period that you have before you have to file for the 829. So at least, you know, with some definitive dates, it's easier for investors and it's easier for developers to figure out basically when money needs to be returned and when what they need to do with the project.
Well, Mona, you hinted at this earlier that I was going to ask you about it. And no, now I am. It wasn't all good stuff, right? I was reading your blog post from a couple of weeks ago regarding the redeployment. Could you tell the listener a little bit about what that is? And then we'll dive in. It's obvious from your post why you think this is a bad idea and really what some of the disastrous consequences could be.
Right. Well, thank you, Mark. Yes, at least I'm getting the chance to voice my concerns again. Yeah, well, first of all, for anybody who's not sure about redeployment, what redeployment basically is when the investment capital has been returned to the developer and is reinvested in another project. For example, we have a project developer who has senior assisted living homes, for example. One of the senior assisted living homes is completed and they have a sale for that, and they're getting an amazing offer, and they really, as a developer, they don't want to lose this amazing offer. But because of all of these adjudication delays, the investors still don't even have their 526s approved, let alone even starting the conditional residence period. So what does that developer do? Does the developer let this amazing offer go? Well, the developer thinks no, because this is the world of business too. You know, we're not just focusing on immigration and rules. We are trying to marry everything up with business. So the developer takes the offer, has this amazing offer, which is great for the investors because they've had their money back. But guess what? She can't give the money back because the money still has to remain at risk, at least until the 526s are all approved. So what does the developer do with that money? It can't just sit there, and it would be dumb to just sit there because it would just be something that the investors would have to pay taxes on. So she reinvests that money into, say, another project. That's what is a classic example of redeployment.
So Mona, we've been hearing about redeployment for a bit now, but is it actually really required under the law?
Well, that's the big argument, because USCIS seemed to think recently that it does, whereas I know several of my colleagues in the EB-5 field agree that it's not. The whole point is the at-risk element, that money has to remain at risk. And yes, money has to remain at, it has to be at risk when you file the 526. But by the time you get to the 829 stage, there is no reference in statute, in regulations, or precedent decisions that the capital still has to be remain at risk after the jobs have been created, and certainly not through the 829 stage. So I have argued that there is no intention by Congress to install a further level of risk by redeploying capital, which is what's happening. Because if you redeploy capital a second time, again, you're putting the money again at risk.
And the way it's written, it's risk that, well, the investor really didn't get to look at or opt into, right?
Right. Well, that's my big argument, because the investor really doesn't have that much of a choice. I mean, if the developer says, hey, this is a great project, I'm putting your money in that, the investor can say, can we see the documents? But they don't really have a choice. Mm-hmm. So if an investor doesn't have a choice, that's impeding on the investor's rights. Mm-hmm. It's giving the developer huge leverage. And it's also, you know, leverage, which is, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars here. If we start talking about long adjudication delays, 10 years for people from mainland China, you're talking about billions of dollars of money, which is just sitting there. And there's no cost to that money. That money's already been brought in, and then they've already paid marketing fees, etc. So there's a lot of capital. It's ripe for fraud. It's ripe for putting into more riskier projects. It's a bad decision to allow investors to be able to redeploy this kind of capital.
Mm. So what could be done? Do you recommend any possible solutions vice this redeployment?
Well, yes. In my blog piece, I did come up with a solution. It's not the best of solutions, and I'm sure that people would argue against it. But first of all, I would argue that no, you have to give your money back or put it in an account at the 829 stage because it doesn't have to be at risk anymore. But it, say USCIS decides that, yes, the money still needs to be at risk. And it's not just USCIS. If there is litigation and the courts decide that the money remains to be at risk, as long as it meets all securities laws, meaning that everybody's been informed where it has to go, then because there's such a high bar now on developers, there can be safeguards attached. The safeguards that I would suggest is that a body, it doesn't have to be USCIS, but the government could put up a body that could oversee the redeployment of capital. And perhaps there could be an application made for this. And there should be strict standards by which the money is allowed to be redeployed.
Right. As long as they don't use the current adjudicators that are should be processing applications right now, right?
Right. Well, I would argue that USCIS really are not the right body to even look at this because they don't have that kind of expertise which would be required when you're talking about so much money coming in and being redeployed.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it almost makes me wonder, why does USCIS, why are they bringing up this redeployment? Because it seems like it's adding undue risk. It really doesn't address the processing delays. So you got to wonder, why is it that they're even introducing
this? Well,
that's
a million-dollar question, and there could be something underlying. But I would say if I had to put my money on it, bearing in mind the way that everything has been written in the policy manual, there were hints at putting money towards infrastructure and possible bonds, that perhaps USCIS is looking for a way to redeploy money towards infrastructure. Again, I would fiercely oppose such a measure because we deal with investors a lot, as you know, and many, many investors cannot afford not to have their money back. Mm-hmm. They want their money back. And if the money is being tied up in infrastructure projects, that could keep it tied up.
Years.
Yeah.
Years.
And there is no guarantee that a bond would be able to mean that your money's coming back either. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm very against this for many reasons.
For many, many reasons. Yeah. And you wrote about it a couple of weeks ago. It's very apparent that you've got a lot of reasons why this is just a bad deal. And for the person listening, if you ever get a chance to pull Mona aside in private and ask her, why do you think they're doing this? And then trust me, she will open up more, even more. Well, Mona, Rebecca, thank you so much for, well, talking about what's going on with EB5.
Thank you, Mark. And we'll be back for more.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.